Hi, I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And I'm Maya Garantz.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
You're ready to ruin stuff, aren't you? I'm so ready to ruin stuff. I'm really looking forward to it. So how are you doing? What are you drinking?
I'm doing great, and I'm drinking some booze. I'm having a cocktail that is whatever was left in my cocktail bar over here. It's, I think, tequila and amaretto, which is what I had last time.
Do you think that when you finish this bottle of amaretto, you're going to like get another, like have, are you developing a taste for it?
Okay. Honestly, kind of. Yeah. You know, when I think of amaretto, and look, hey, I have a degree in bartending. Okay.
You do? I didn't know you did that. Is that how you like paid your bills when you were a young thing?
It actually is. I mean, it's not like a degree. It's a certificate. And so I know a lot about cocktails, but my familiarity with amaretto was like, you know, an amaretto sour, like a lot of pretty sweet drinks. And I recently, in this quest to finish the amaretto, I've discovered that you can mix it with a lot of interesting things. You can mix it with scotch. You can mix it with tequila. You can mix it with gin. I've done all those things. And if you do it in the right proportions, it can be very nice. I think I will continue to drink amaretto. I don't know.
Oh,
I might do that.
All right.
Yeah. How about you? What are you drinking, Maya?
Well, I'm finishing up the Meyer lemons before they died. I'm having a Meyer lemon whiskey sour. And because citrus plus brown liquor, that's kind of my thing.
I feel that.
Also, I'm experimenting a little bit today. A good joint friend of ours left me with some very nice and very mild edibles the last time that she stayed with me. So I'm going to see if that affects my, you know, my general brilliance tonight.
Oh, that's exciting. How long ago did you eat them? Because they take like 2 hours.
Right before I called you.
Okay.
So if all of a sudden I just start talking really slowly.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
So that's the tension of this episode. Yeah. When is it going to fucking hit, Maya? Oh.
All right. I'm going to pay attention to your demeanor and see if I notice a change. So we should read some listener feedback. We're going to do some updates about what's going on this week. And then we've got a couple of big topics to get into. So let's start with that listener feedback. We got a tweet that you wanted to share.
Yes, from Matthew Elmsley, who lives in Canada, who says, you know what? The Sauce is a really good podcast. Every time I listen to it these days, there are multiple times an episode where I say, damn it, now that's a really good point. This should be more widely understood. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.
If we have reached one person... Huh.
That's wonderful.
Then we are not doing this for naught. I mean, if nobody listened, I would just enjoy these conversations with Rebecca every week.
That's true. It's just kind of fun.
It's really pleasurable, but I really thank you for that.
Yeah. And thank you for tweeting us up. Thank you for letting those who follow you on Twitter know, because that's how we spread the word. And if we want to keep doing this, we are going to have to get more listeners.
Yeah. So, you know, spread the fucking word, guys. Write more of these tweets.
Yes.
And what was my favorite part of this tweet was actually a response from one of his friends who said, thanks, I'll check it out, Brosif.
Excellent.
Even Brosifs want to listen to people who make really good fucking points. Okay?
Exactly. So speaking of good points, you tweeted this week an article by Rebecca Traister that I thought was fucking on the nose. It was in The Cut, and the title was, This Moment Isn't Just About Sex. It's really about work.
About work.
As soon as I saw that title, I was like, yes, this is what we have been talking about. Amazing article, and I recommend everyone read it. It's just about this fundamental issue in how we're talking about the Me Too phenomenon.
And that's right.
Yeah. The issue being that there's a lot of focus on the sexual aspect of it. There's a lot of focus on the really sort of lurid, salacious aspects of it. But fundamentally, what almost all of these stories has in common is they're about women at work, women trying to get work opportunities or take advantage of work opportunities, women trying to further their career or start their careers.
Right. I just want to read this quote from her where she says, "What makes women vulnerable is not their carnal viability, but rather the way that their worth has been understood as fundamentally erotic, ornamental, that they have not been taken seriously as equals, that they are treated as some ancillary reward that comes with a kind of power men are taught to reach for and valued for achieving. That the smaller trespasses, little grabs and unwanted kisses, that's not about the sexualized act. It's about the cruel reminder that these are the terms on which we're still valued. The men we tricked ourselves into thinking might see us as smart, formidable colleagues or rivals. It's not that we're horrified like some Victorian damsel. It's that we're horrified like a woman in 2017 who briefly believed she was equal to her male peers, but has just been reminded that she is not. And I feel like that is what so many of us have been dealing with. Like, like it's not that he whipped his dick out.
Right, which is bad. It's bad. You shouldn't do that in any context. But I feel like that piece is so still missing from the conversation. It isn't necessarily just about the sexual aspect of it. It's about, she said it so well. It's about, like, you thought for a minute that you were in that room because you mattered as a person, as a professional, that you thought it was about you, and it wasn't.
And in terms of people who do not get it, I've got to call out Wesley Yang, who wrote for Tablet about Lauren Stein, editor of the Paris Review, or former editor who just resigned. And he writes about how, the scoundrel's time is done, and now we're living in this very, like, Antioch time. So I'm just going to read this quote about how we were living, it becomes increasingly clear, in a lawless interregnum between the widespread desublimation that began in the 60s and whatever lies ahead of us, when new rules couched in the language of safety and respect will regulate us. You'll have to seek verbal consent before you kiss a woman or touch her in a sensitive place or anywhere. He's painting this world in which all of this reckoning that's happening is creating some uptight Puritan world antiseptic, super uptight life. Like,
right.
Sex is gonna happen, Wesley. I promise you.
Right.
Fucking is gonna happen. But what we're trying to make different is the way in which we are not reduced to only being a sexual object. I promise you. Like, you will get yours and we will get ours, my friend. But this way in which he's trying to conflate women having some kind of command or control over their sexual and professional lives with this kind of, like, uptight, the twilight of the charming scoundrel. Oh, come on, man.
Yeah, that's really fucked up. He cannot envision a world, like you said, cannot envision a world where women and men are equally empowered and engaging in sex together as total equals with clear consent. And when it's also sexy and hot. Like, examine that for a second, dude. Just examine that for a second. Let's talk about the big topic of the evening, Maya.
Woohoo! Woohoo!
All right, we are recording on Tuesday night. And the results have just come in from the Alabama Senate race. Indeed. Doug Jones has emerged triumphant against all odds.
I don't even know what to say. We are going to have a Democratic senator from
Alabama.
Jesus Christ.
It's amazing. Aside from how happy we are, we have a lot of thoughts about what this victory means. Not politically per se, but culturally and in terms of the direction the country is going in general.
Yes.
What does this outcome tell us about the sort of conventional wisdom around politics, around electoral politics specifically.
And what I've been thinking about a lot, because I'm also thinking about the Virginia election, the New Jersey election that happened, you know, a month ago. And I'm thinking about this moment that happened, the moment where Obama, in an interview, seemingly kind of out of nowhere, was like, yeah, I think gay marriage is fine.
Right, right, right. Yeah, up till then, he had been sort of, well, my views are evolving. I respect gay people, but I believe it's between a man and a woman and all that stuff. And then he just sort of like got it out there. He was like, no, I think I'm for gay marriage now. Yeah. I think
that there was this performance that all Democrats were expected to do. I remember Hillary doing it. Mm-hmm, Everybody did it. Gay, there can be a civil union between gay people, but marriage is really between a man and a woman. Right, and it was this like tightrope that they walked. And we all knew why they were walking it. We all knew that none of them believed it. We all knew that it was this kind of performance. And then all of a sudden, Obama's like, yeah, you know, that's bullshit. Gay marriage is fine. And it evaporated. This thing that had seemed like such a giant structure evaporated into thin air.
Yeah.
And I've been feeling that with like the Virginia election, that some of the seats that were won in the Virginia legislature had been uncontested Republican held seats for like decades.
Yeah.
For years. And all of a sudden somebody ran and all the conventional wisdom that says that it can't happen.
Yeah.
Just evaporates, like just so gone. Much morning dew, just
right, right.
And it makes me think of the ways in which Republicans and conservatives have driven what is the conventional wisdom for a very long time. And we're in a really weird moment with all of that conventional wisdom. And I think I'm wondering, what else can we articulate that it's possible to evaporate right now?
All right. So I have one.
Yes.
The abortion debate. I think this really applies because for the past, I mean, for a good 20 years now, if not more, the conventional wisdom has been you have to be against abortion, even if you're for abortion rights. But politicians have to say, well, I abhor abortion, or it's a very difficult decision that no woman wants to have to make.
Safe, legal, and rare.
Yeah. But it's been this sort of convention that you just sort of have to do that. You're not allowed to say there's nothing wrong with abortion. It's fine. You're not allowed to say my personal beliefs and religion do not find that it's a moral hazard. You're not allowed to say that it's good, that women's lives get better because of it.
I read this amazing story called My Body, the Mosh Pit. And this woman was writing about how when she was pregnant, it was found out that the fetus had intense structural defects that this child was not going to live. And she was going to have this abortion. And it leads to this longer conversation about the ways in which, strangely, ultrasound technology, when you have it, it makes the mother disappear.
Yeah.
You don't see the mother in the picture. And all of a sudden, you can imagine the fetus as this independent entity.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas before that, you know that it's not a thing yet. It is not a thing that is separate from the mother yet. Even the personhood debate is driven by this sort of Republican conversation. Oh,
yeah. They've pushed the conversation so far by taking this extreme stance, right? Human life begins at conception. And not only is it human life in an abstract sense, but it is a literal human being with as much rights as
an
any
autonomy,
living.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
That it is a child, a baby, the same as one that's already born. And when they start the conversation from that place, you have no room to discuss that. What are you going to tell them? Like that if that's their sincerely held belief, they claim, which I actually doubt.
Yes.
I don't really believe that most people think that. But
yes.
But once you've established this idea that abortion, even at the earliest stages, is murder. It's literally murder of an infant, of a baby.
Yes. Yes.
And like, well, how can you argue against that? All you can say is like, well, if if we allow it to be legal, then at least the mom won't die too. As opposed right. to, look, this, you know, is a single mom who already has a kid and she doesn't want to have another one. And her kid's life and her life will be better if she can just have this abortion and it will be fine. It will be fine.
That's right. Well, also, there's this like performance about how difficult a decision it is.
Oh, and I hate that.
For a lot of women, the procedure is not something that they're sitting there staying up nights thinking about. And for some women, they are. And I feel like that's also part of it, too.
And that's fine. Yeah.
There's a lot of things that are complicated, but there's ways in which Republicans have sort of staged what the conversation looks like.
Exactly.
And maybe that can evaporate.
Exactly. So getting back to tonight's topic, what is the conventional wisdom that maybe has been either reinforced or undermined by what happened tonight in Alabama?
Oh, I think the conventional wisdom is that, this is going to sound really obvious, but that the South is Republican territory.
I mean, to be fair, Roy Moore is about as bad a candidate as you could have, right? And he, you know, we're talking about a 48% to 50%
right.
outcome.
Right.
So
right.
it's not some kind of resounding like, wow, the Democrats really made inroads there.
Well, although to be fair, there was some serious voter suppression today. So like, who knows how many more votes there could have
right.
been.
Right. That's true. That's true. So it does kind of show that Republicans don't have this like thorough stranglehold on
right.
even the deepest South states. Look, okay, here's the truth. Anytime any state that has a city in it, it's not guaranteed red. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And actually Birmingham is a blue city.
Yeah.
It's pretty fucking rad. We forget the history of populism in the South. We forget the ways in which racism is the only reason we lost the South. And as LBJ famously said, like, we have lost the South for a generation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been more than a generation. We might have lost it for a couple of generations, but we're also seeing a giant age gap, a giant generational gap.
It is very encouraging to see that the sort of under 30 generation are pretty fucking progressive.
And they're progressive in different ways. I think that there are things that they are more progressive about. I think they're more progressive about race.
Oh, for sure.
Weirdly enough, mm-hmm. I don't know about them being more progressive about women.
Yeah.
And I think that sexism is...
Oh, gosh. That's true.
In terms of progress, there is something that's very, like, stubborn about sexism.
Sexism. I agree with that. What I see, actually, from young people is that they are kind of more socialist. Like, they really do buy into those sort of social democrat. I know Bernie calls himself a democratic socialist, but he's misusing that term. He's a social democrat. And sorry to be pedantic about it, but it's true.
You never have to apologize for that.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. This is my safe space for pedantry.
That's right.
And
that's right.
That's important to me. So I think that's wonderful. Like, young people are pretty in favor of things like, you know, social safety net, socialized medicine, single payer. Like, they like stuff like that. They want stuff
right.
like that. They've
right.
seen, they've been kind of fucked over, and they don't buy into a lot of the shit that the baby boomers buy into about their own entitlement and how everything they have they earned and all this shit. Like, millennials are like, no, we followed all your rules and went to college and worked hard and did all your shit, and now we're struggling to get by, and it's not fucking right. And I, good on them. The conventional wisdom that I really hope that this election helps to dispel is the one about the white working class voters.
Ugh.
The Democrats have been spending about 30 years belly aching about how do we get working class, and they mean white working class people,
yeah.
to vote for their own economic interest. How do
right.
we convince them about, like, you know, all those things I just mentioned, single payer and higher minimum wage and all these things that Democrats have been advocating that would help people in their position, and yet they vote Republican for cultural reasons. I mean, right. the obvious truth of it is that they're racist pieces of shit. That's the truth, right? I mean, that's the Southern strategy you're referring to, right?
Yeah.
The Republicans were smart enough in the 60s, Nixon was smart enough to recognize that there were these Dixiecrats who were up for grabs because the Democrats were going to move forward on civil rights. And he turned them into Republicans. And Democrats have been like chasing their tails ever since, thinking that they have to appeal to these people. I think this race is a really interesting, this Alabama Senate race is an interesting example, with Roy Moore being just like so obviously a child molester, and even without that, a real extremist.
He lost his judgeship twice. I mean, he was such an embarrassment to the Republican Party.
Exactly. He should be unelectable by any metric, right? By any objective standard. My thought was, what's a better strategy for Doug Jones? You know, this is my thinking in the run-up to the election. Is this a strategy to try to appeal to those people who were going to vote Republican and, like, show them how bad Roy Moore is and talk about how he has sex with little girls? Or is the better strategy to try to get black people out to the polls, try to get Democrats who've been sort right. of like demoralized by living in Alabama and their vote never really mattering, just get them out to the polls? And I feel like Hillary did try to get those Republicans that would be disenchanted by Trump. I think she saw an opportunity there and overestimated how much she could draw from that. And I don't know what the Doug Jones campaign did. Whatever they did, it worked.
I mean, the Doug Jones campaign, and this is something that I think has been interesting in terms of the national media's ability to understand local races. Like, I think we focus on national races because that's a story that the national media feels confident to tell. And the reason that there are these, you know, surprise moments is because they don't understand Doug Jones's campaign. From what I know, there was a lot of door knocking. There was a lot of very organized ground game. Mm-hmm. There were disenchanted Republicans. And I think that there was a lot of hoping that those Republicans would just stay home.
Yeah.
And I think that that was sort of a huge part of it. I think we're seeing huge black turnout, even like higher black turnout than even when Obama ran in 2008.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. But that's kind of what I'm talking about, right? Like,
right.
You know, you can really hope that the Roy Moore people will stay home. But I feel like for every sort of moderate Republican who's so disgusted they stay home, there's some, you know, wackadoo who's energized by how much the liberals hate Roy Moore.
Yes, that's right.
And it kind of evens out. I don't know if you can count on that electorally.
No, I think you have to count on people actually like doing the fucking work to get voters out to the polls, to get our likely voters out to the polls.
Yes.
In terms of conventional wisdom and what works, there is somebody on Twitter, Al Giordano. He is, I'm not sure if he's a journalist. Yeah, he's a journalist.
Yeah.
And he wrote, just spoke with a source in the Mobile, Alabama County NAACP. Here are some things that are happening today on the ground in Alabama that did not happen in the 2016 election. So there is a list of things that they did in this election. The state NAACP instructed its local branches to call every registered voter in the state who did not vote in 2016. The Lower Alabama chapter made it through the entire list successfully. A dozen paid canvassers have been going door to door in the Mobile area all week. This did not happen in 2016. What last year was an ad hoc effort by a group of friends to offer rides to the poll is more than a dozen organizations doing rides to the poll with resources for drivers. Mm-hmm. Once the Jones campaign had money, it bought billboards in African-American neighborhoods with the election date and a blurb about Jones. Not on highways, but in places where one would normally see fast food or cigarette ads. So he has a 9-tweet thread mm-hmm. that is talking about the on-the-ground work that happened in Alabama in this election. It's actually not 9 tweets. It's like 13 tweets.
That's amazing. And what strikes me about that is my first thought when you started reading that was, well, why didn't Hillary's campaign do that? And then I thought, well, because it was Alabama. Because who would think that there was a chance in Alabama? But this is what we're talking about. Conventional wisdom, right?
But also what's interesting about that is that then you would say, but one of the big critiques of Hillary's loss is, why didn't she make sure to shore up Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, because they were starting to spread out to places like Arizona because they thought, oh, maybe we can get this because Trump is such a fucker. And now we're saying, well, why didn't she fight for Alabama? I feel like we are in this sort of sticky place where the sort of Obama 50 state, we're going to fight for every state strategy was not as disciplined in the Hillary election.
Yeah.
But at the same time, one of the things that we seem to regret about that election was that the focus wasn't put on the Rust Belt states, whose collapse led to the end. The focus was put on North Carolina, on Florida, mm-hmm. on these mm-hmm. swing states. That's where the resources went.
Yeah. But that's also part of the conventional wisdom.
Right.
There are these states that are red and these states that are blue. And then there are these swing states. And who's going to fucking waste their time? Like, there's the purple ones, you know, there's the ones that have been red and we could get them. And that's no joke.
Right.
That's a real thing. But it would change the game if we would say, if we really bust our asses and do shit right, no state is red for sure.
And I think that that's what the indivisible move has been, and flippable, and sister district, and run for something. Mm-hmm. Emily's List is like, holy shit, we have never had this many women contacting us wanting to run for
amazing
stuff. I think that we are in a very interesting moment, and I think it's a good time for us to make a list of the conventional wisdoms and see if we can, instead of by fighting the conventional wisdom, that we're not the wingnut crazies, that we're actually like, no, this is the new establishment.
Yeah. Change the paradigm.
Mm. All right. Well, you know what? We're not going to stop talking about this because 2018, guys, there's going to be some, it's going to be a year. I'm telling you right now.
We're bringing it.
Midterm elections. Democrats are going to bring it.
Be there. All right, Maya, did you read Cat Person?
I read Cat Person. Did you read Cat Person?
I did read Cat Person. So I really wanted to talk about this. This is like a thing that happened online for like 12 hours. And it deeply activated my whole fear of missing out, my FOMO, because I was traveling all weekend and I wasn't really paying attention to Twitter, and I checked in and it was like this whole thing had already happened, and I was like, oh,
right,
God damn it. So, little background. It was a short story that ran in the New Yorker, as short stories do, right? A fiction piece. And it kind of went viral.
There's always one.
Right.
There's like, there is actually.
That's like, that's New Yorker's
thing.
That's
how it works.
That's how it works. Yeah. So, it kind of went viral, which is unusual for a short story, and engendered a certain amount of controversy. It's about a young woman, a 20-year-old college student, who gets in this relationship with a guy who's some years older and wants to have sex with him, but then the sex is bad and she basically abandons him. Spoiler alert, but like, that's what I learned before I read it. And so I was reading about how so many people, particularly men, seemed to be interpreting it as a memoir or an essay. Like, they were talking about it in these terms, like it was just this woman writing about her own life and how she was really shallow. Then other people were writing about how weird it is that so many people are mistaking this short story for an essay. So I'm like, I better read this. And I was expecting it to be, you know, a confessional memoir.
Right.
And the first line of the story, Margot met Robert on a Wednesday night toward the end of her fall semester. And I was like, wait a minute. It's clearly a short story. Like, that's the first sentence. It's in third person. Margot met Robert. I don't, where is this confusion coming from?
I think what was also interesting about the reaction to it that I saw that sort of sent me to reading it, people were talking about this story in terms of the Me Too conversation, because it's about like bad sex. And I was like, and then I read it and I was like, this has nothing to do with, like, I didn't understand what was going on. Like, I see why people are making that connection, but that's not what the story is.
It's not.
The story is about the strange, erotic power dynamics between a younger woman and an older man, but it's not about any kind of professional setting, but it's about this fantasy. And I think what was really interesting to me about reading it, which again is an experience we talked about some weeks ago, how like when I saw Broad City, it's like the only time I've ever seen me.
Yeah.
Like, I think that what was striking to me about the story was that in some ways, when I first read it, I didn't appreciate how well crafted it was because it was all so familiar to me.
That's what I loved about it. I don't want to say I was like floored by it, but I was definitely struck by it because she talks about, the author talks about, in describing her character's experience, moments, especially her internal moments, that resonated with me as just being so familiar and true. And it's not, it's not just that. It's that I've never heard these things talked about or depicted before. Like, and that in itself kind of like gave me pause.
Those calculations, those minute calculations that are being made by this young woman about her desirability and in her relation to her own desire. And yeah, it's very rare that those things, I think, have ever been articulated.
That whole idea that she is turned on by him being turned on by her.
Mm-hmm.
There's a truth in that really struck me. And there's just a truth about like the dynamics of relationships and being young and trying to figure out what you want and what you have to offer. And
what it is about men who are older. There is that feeling like there's something glamorous about me because I'm able to have this interaction with this older man.
Yeah.
And all of the weird calculations happening before that. And then obviously for this older man, there's similar calculations about having this interaction with a much younger woman that are happening.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had that experience too, where there were these older men who clearly wanted to turn me into this character, much as I was turning them into a character.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And who behaved with a really brutal hostility when I ultimately didn't give them what they wanted. Which brings us to the Twitter
the Twitter reaction to it. And I do think that's partially a good explanation of why so many men on Twitter, at least, had issues with it, is because it does depict him turning vicious toward her because she is not kind to him. And it's not like this imbalanced thing. It's like he does some fucked up things, she does some fucked up things. It's about negotiating a weird relationship with a lot of interesting dynamics going on. And ultimately, she behaves like a 20-year-old.
Yes.
And I feel like the very specific ending of the story kind of reflected, it kind of echoed behaviors that women complain about men doing, that women complain about nice, quote unquote, nice guys, right? Self-described nice guys who aren't really nice. And they reach out to you in a nice way. And when you're like, no, thanks, they're like, fuck you, whore. You're like, oh, you weren't nice. And that's a whole discourse, right? That's a whole thing that's been talked about for years, in particularly online and in social media. So I think in having similar things happen in the story, it caused a lot of people to read the story as being an overt comment on, I don't know, on nice guys, on feminism.
What's been very interesting is the way that a lot of men have been reacting to the story as if they're the guy who's being rejected.
I know. I was fascinated by the reaction to it, in part because I went into it expecting it to be essay-like. I thought it was going to be in first person and kind of not very literary sounding, you know, not at all, sort of lacking artistry to the point where you might mistake it for someone's confessional essay. But it's not like right. that at all. It's beautifully written. It's very nicely written and evocative and in third person. So that made me ask, what the fuck is going on? Do people not know how to read literature at all?
Right.
do they not know how it works? I mean, yes, I recognize that teaching kids how to think critically about literature is a challenge, and that maybe not all high school programs are up to it.
I have to jump in here and say that one thing that I saw from the students who came out of the No Child Left Behind years and from the students that I had who came up in those years, because they were my college students when I was a graduate student at UC Irvine, was that they would read kind of for comprehension, and they didn't sense irony or sarcasm or a sense of humor. They didn't have
tone. They had no sense of the tone of the piece.
They didn't. They were reading for facts.
Yeah.
That was shocking to me.
Everything you're saying is really fascinating to me, and I kind of want to have a whole separate conversation about it. Because number one, I was a teacher during the No Child Left Behind years. And I mean, I taught elementary school, but like I was teaching the kids how to read. But at the same time, because of No Child Left Behind, so much focus was on the testing, right? And one of the things you find as a teacher who's training kids to take a test that's going to determine your worth as a teacher is that the easiest and most foolproof way to improve their score is to teach them, find the questions that ask you about a specific fact or piece of information, go back to the passage and find where it talks about that, reread that section, and you can answer the question. Like that's... it's just the easiest thing to do. Now, there's always questions on tone and main idea. And they're always badly worded and they're never accurate about what the tone actually is. But I hate fucking standardized tests. But teaching a kid to recognize irony is so much harder than teaching a kid, if they ask you why Marie wore a pink hat with blue flowers, scan the text for blue flowers, find it. That this is a whole other conversation, but it is connected, because I am concerned about people's critical thinking skills and people's ability to read texts. And I don't mean literally read and have literal comprehension, right? I mean the way we use read in film studies read a film, you know, people's ability to interpret, to understand the unspoken.
Right. And understanding where something is leaving you.
Yes.
Like, it is leaving me in this messy place. What is the messy place in which it is leaving me? And I feel like one thing that's interesting, my friend Nikki teaches poetry. And one of the things that she trains her writing students to do is that when you're talking about a poem, you don't say, well, you say, no, the speaker.
Yeah.
Because the speaker, the voice of the poem, is not you as a person.
Right.
It is the speaker of the poem, even if you are using your experience to get into something. And that's what's very strange about these men who think that this woman who's like a PhD student at Harvard, like who's lived this big life, like no 20-year-old woman is going to fucking write this story, dude. Like, she's too well written.
She's a professional fucking writer. She's not a 20-year-old college student who doesn't know what she wants and doesn't know how to break up with a guy. There is this. Okay, so somebody started a Twitter called Men React to Cat Person, which I love. And they just screen capped tweets and other reactions. And many of their issues surround the assumption that this is just a woman writing about her own experience. It's clearly just some dumb 20-something girl writing.
Who's so mean.
She's such a mean girl. And she's just writing about her own experience. It couldn't possibly be a grown-up woman. I mean, who cares if it's even a young woman? Like, it's a good story. But it couldn't possibly be a self-aware person who has some thoughts about relationships and figuring out who you are in college.
Weird power tensions and dynamics and,
No, people want it to be, clearly this is what happened to her and she's just telling the story of her own life. She couldn't have made it up. One of my favorites of these men reacting tweets was comparing her to Salinger. I liked this one. This reeks of the personal self-involved literature like Catcher in the Rye, yet Salinger channeled something that he was not. All this channels is a technically proficient diatribe about a personal experience. I felt like I just read someone's Facebook post and nothing more.
Oh, wow.
And he goes on. Can we even unpack this? Like, first of all, this assumption that when Salinger's writing Catcher in the Rye, when he's writing about Holden Caulfield, that he made that up. That's something he was not. He could never have been an adolescent boy who was kind of lost and alone and finding his place in the world.
No, he channeled something greater because he's a genius.
Right. He's a genius, as men can be. But when a woman writes something about a 20-something woman, that must just be her own personal experience that she's trying to disguise as literature. As if, first of all, as if, like, what's the difference? If it's a personal experience or not, that doesn't make it literature or not.
Well, and it also reminds me, so I have this, I mean, this is a conversation for another time, but I have been listening to a little bit of country music this past year. And there are some it's we're going to have this conversation because there are some women that you really need to know about.
Okay.
Because they're fucking awesome.
All right. Future topic.
I remember reading this interview with Miranda Lambert where they were talking about like personal experiences. It was either Miranda Lambert and Angelina Presley, but they were talking about like personal experiences and the way people take it. And she's like, but it's a song. Like, I use personal experience to help me write it, but I am a songwriter.
Yeah.
I write songs. Hello. Like, obviously not everything is this like autobiography. I'm crafting this thing from my personal experience. But I'm wondering if it is a little gendered where it's like, when women do it, it can't be that it's craft.
That it's like exactly.
Really well-crafted thing where we know the difference between our life and like what we are making.
Right.
Can't happen.
When Eminem raps about beating up women or hating gay people, it's Slim Shady. It's a character. He's not advocating those views.
That's right.
But when Taylor Swift sings about a relationship, that's literally what happened to Taylor Swift.
Yeah, that's right.
That's exactly how she feels. And we're going to figure out exactly which ex she's talking about right now.
And also why she's wrong.
Why she's wrong, right? This kind of like, especially that dumb fucking tweet, kind of brought that into like a nice contrast for me to realize that when Salinger writes like about a boy's experience, it's universal. It's literature. It's great. It's the human condition. But when a woman writes about her experience, it's self-indulgent and shallow. And I never fucking related to Holden Caulfield, okay? I sort of understood that I was supposed to. And I remember writing things in English class that pretended that I identified with it because I knew I was supposed to.
Right. Oh, we knew what we were supposed to do.
Like, I'm just so fucking done with this assumption that men's narratives are universal narratives. But also, the other issue that I see in this cat person discourse is the idea that if you're writing about a relationship that ends with a nice guy calling a girl a whore over text,
you
must be making a point. Like, I wish I could say that in capital letters, you know, say that capitalized with like a little trademark symbol. You're making a point. And that's part of why people treated it as an essay or a think piece rather than as just a short story. People want their fiction to be making a point, telling them what the author thinks and what the author thinks they should think. Who told people that that's what fiction is supposed to do?
So I'm an artist and I've seen the shift in funding towards sort of community-based work or towards work that's going to get more points of view, which is awesome. But there's this weird side to it where the work that gets funded is the work that also then makes a point.
Do people not understand the difference between having a point of view and making a point? Because those are two different things.
That's one thing that I'm finding really interesting right now is like, I did this piece with a colleague, Ellen Sebastian Chang, where we redid this. There is this famous video art piece from 1981, which was like the first video chat, where they set up a live video chat between New York and LA. Is the mother of all video chats. This was in 81. It freaked people the fuck out. It was called Hole in Space.
They had video chat in 1981.
They created it. These two artists, Kit Galloway and Sherry Rabinowitz, were this couple who were just visionaries. These guys were visionaries. And they had this sort of techno-utopian fantasy. And originally they were going to get the US and the USSR to be in this live chat over video. But that wasn't going to work. So they got LA and New York, like Lincoln Center and a mall in Century City. And they didn't explain anything. It was just these screens were up and people kind of figured it out. It was amazing.
Somebody should do that now. Even with today's technology, I still feel like that would knock people out.
Okay, so we did that. But what we did was we did a different version of it because now I can FaceTime with my family in Israel. Like, who gives a shit? Like,
right.
But I don't know people who are living two blocks away. So what we did is we restaged A Hole in Space, but we did it between two Oakland neighborhoods that are right next to each other, but are socioeconomically completely different.
I'm going to cry. This is amazing. This is amazing.
So for a week, Rockridge, which is like the fancy white neighborhood, and International Boulevard, every night there was a live video chat where they saw each other live. So here's the thing about it. I think what the funders wanted and what the story is that people wanted is that we connected these two neighborhoods that are socioeconomically and racially different, that are dealing with the same pot of civic money, but dealing with very different problems.
Can I guess? They wanted you to show that they looked past their differences and saw their common humanity.
That's right. And that they connected and that they had these conversations. And that is not what happened. What happened was that people walked past these screens on their own cell phones and didn't even notice that it was happening.
What happened was
that people on International Boulevard were like, why the fuck are you putting more surveillance in my neighborhood? And people in Rockridge complained about the fact that it was noisy.
Oh, wow.
This is what happened. And a lot of what made the piece important was the ways in which they didn't connect. The moments that were interesting were the moments that were not, that were messy and that were not making a point, but that were showing how complicated it was. And that's a harder story to tell. And people don't want to hear it, or they don't want to fund the next thing. And that's what I'm saying. Like, as an artist, that thing about making a point as opposed to creating a framework by which we deal with things that are difficult, it's a harder sell right now.
Shit's complicated. People don't seem to want that.
No, and let's get complicated about the way that this male character is clearly performing some power on this female character, and she's performing power against him and trying to assert who they are.
It's complicated. It's not like, okay, I run into this all the fucking time with my work, okay? Particularly with my webcomic. Okay, let's be fair. It's called The Adventures of Gynostar, and the tagline is Fighting the Forces of Evil and Male Chauvinism. It's about a feminist superhero. That's like the whole joke. So I don't necessarily blame anyone for walking into the comic expecting it to be like, oh, this is going to be like pro-feminism. It's going to have sexist villains and a feminist hero, and she's going to use feminism to defeat them. Like that. That seems to be what's being advertised. Yes. So I'm not going to deny that.
Yes.
But that's not necessarily what the comic is. It's a little more complicated than that because feminism is complicated. Like, feminism is full of contradictions and hypocrisies and battles over which direction to go. Feminism is not a clear-cut, simple thing. And even in the cases where it is, it's like, if you're a feminist, you still live in a patriarchal society, and just negotiating that requires you to make all kinds of compromises. And that's what I like to explore. That's where I find are the areas of humor. So what I find endlessly amusing is I get a lot of like, I thought this was just like a feminist, you know, diatribe, but then I started reading it and Kino Star always kind of loses. So now I realize it's totally anti-feminism.
Oh, wow. That's wow. Like, really?
Yeah, but I also get feminists who, you know, take issue with some of my dark humor. I would call it dark humor. And like, look, I'm enough of a feminist that I'm open to hearing what they have to say. Like, right. If you're going to be like, you know, the way you're talking about disability in this comic is really problematic, I'm going to listen. I'm not saying 100% I'm going to agree, but I will definitely listen. But it's those areas where the comic appears to be not 100% feminist, and feminists are like not comfortable with it. And sometimes right. They'll even sort of like do a cognitive dissonance thing where they like make justifications for how I'm actually making a very feminist message. And it's like, no, I'm really not. I'm actually calling you out. I'm calling you out. Right. I'm saying that this is messy. This is fucking right. messy. And it's funny. There's humor in that it's messy, but it's true.
So I feel like back to Cat Person and this sort of weird reaction to it, but also that it's so virulent. I mean, I'm sure the New Yorker has not had a short story that has attracted that much response.
I'm honestly like really happy for the New Yorker right now.
Yeah, I know. You're like, good job, New Yorker. Yeah. But I think that we're looking at this way in which we're having a hard time wrestling and negotiating with specifically, I think, stories by women that are not in the framework by which we understand them. And I feel like, uh-huh. like when that happens, people, they just don't have a way into it. And so they're trying to force it. They're trying to shoehorn it into something that they understand. And I do want to mention just briefly, that's what I think happened in its own way with, I have to talk about this, with Tiffany Haddish
okay.
not getting nominated for a Golden Globe
okay.
for Girls. Look.
Seemingly unrelated, but I know you're going to
seemingly unrelated, but I'm going to bring it home. So there was Girls Trip, which is a movie this summer, made $100 million. Jada Pinkett Smith was in it. It was Tiffany Haddish was this big breakout year for her because she was so fucking funny in that movie.
Amazing generally. Yeah.
She's hilarious. And I think that this is like sort of exposed. You're like, here's this hilarious woman who nobody's been noticing. So today, Jada Pinkett Smith was writing about how Tiffany Haddish did not get nominated for Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy. And she said, look, it's not just that she didn't get nominated. It would be fine if she didn't get nominated, but we couldn't even get anybody from the Hollywood Foreign Press to even watch this movie.
Oh, my God.
And this was a huge movie. Yeah, this was a movie that made – this was a huge hit. There was no reason that they shouldn't have just watched it. And she said, we couldn't even get eyes on it.
Yeah.
People have been writing about how like, yeah, well, that's because it is a black movie that is not about black suffering. And that is the only way by which the white film establishment mm-hmm. is going to treat a black movie seriously
right.
or as equivalent or as something that is going to be worthy of conversation and consideration. It's going to have to be 12 Years a Slave.
Right.
It cannot be a movie that is just not even engaging with that discourse at all. And I think that what we're coming to is that when a story is not fitting into the framework that we expect of it, whether it's about sex or gender, there is a real cognitive dissonance that yeah. people are having integrating it into a world of storytelling that they can
yeah.
connect with and understand and say, yeah, it's fiction.
They have no space for this idea that a 20-year-old girl who's kind of a bitch could like actually does have an internal life and like some yes. shit's going on. Like
a complicated internal life, whereas there are 300,000 million coming of age stories about young men
right.
where we see them where it's not that they're a hero or an anti-hero. They're somewhere in between because shit's complicated.
Because and men are complicated. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. But women are not.
Right.
Black people are not. That's right.
Yeah. Grow the fuck up, everyone. Grow the fuck up. Get some more room in your goddamn imaginations.
Oh, we have been drinking tonight. All right.
Maya, have your edibles kicked in yet?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm not locked in my stool. I am sitting on the stool here. I'm not locked there.
No stool lock. Stool lock. Where can people get in touch with you if they have something to say to you directly?
Well, they can go to my website at mayagarance.com, where you can see all of the shows and pieces of art that I have showing right
her,
now.
Her not didactic or dogmatic
yes,
art. Her art rather, that gets shit complicated and makes you think.
That's right. Yeah. And then you can find me at Maya Garance on Twitter, and you can write me at any time, even if you're just going to call me a bitch.
Yeah, call her a bitch. Maya loves that.
I welcome it.
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Gynostar, also Instagram. And you can find me on Patreon, patreon.com/Gynostar. You can contact us both via email at saucepodcast@gmail.com. And we are on Twitter. We are at saucepodcast. Reach out. Let us know your thoughts about Cat Person. Let us know your thoughts about the conventional wisdom in politics that may have been undermined by this amazing result in Alabama tonight.
Oh my God.
And let us know if there's any other shit you want us to ruin.
We'd be happy to.
We'd love to.
We'd love it.
It's yeah. What we do. All right, everyone. Have a good one. We'll talk to you soon.
Next week. Bye.
Bye.